KOO.fm/tunein/turnon.
KBOO is seeking a station manager to lead our dynamic 45-year-old non-commercial radio station. Ideal candidates will have nonprofit management experience, the ability to thrive and work collaboratively in a decentralized organization, and the ability to delegate, plan, and organize people to meet goals and objectives. If this interests you, please go to KBOO.fm/stationmanagerhire2013.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, 16 protesters were arrested last night in eastern Oregon trying to stop the transport of a megaload of oil extraction equipment on its way to the Alberta tar sands.
Portland public school teachers have failed to reach an agreement with the district, and parents plan a rally tomorrow to support the teachers.
We'll hear about a plan to address the decades of pollution in the Willamette River that have resulted in the region's largest Superfund site.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, December 17th, 2013. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Rosalyn Scott. Portland area parents have organized a rally to support the public school teachers in their negotiations for better working conditions. The rally will be held tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. outside the Portland Public School Administration Building on North Dixon Avenue. The teachers' union is currently in the second day of a three-day mediation session with the Portland Public School Administration to try to resolve an impasse. If the impasse is not resolved, the teachers could go on strike in January. For more, KBOO's Jinka Soderberg spoke with Chris Lowe, who is helping to organize the rally.
Chris, can you tell us about tomorrow's rally in support of the teachers' union here in Portland?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for giving me the opportunity. The rally starts at 9 and will go for about an hour. It's a late start school day, so it's a time when teachers are in their classrooms doing prep work and parents need to have something to do with their kids. So, and what we're saying is we're trying to send a message to the school board, which we boiled down to listen to parents, don't force a strike. Drop your final offer and negotiate on everything. Our perspective as parents is that we see the school board as and administration taking a really aggressive posture toward the teachers and pushing things towards a strike that we'd rather not see, and we want them to take up a different kind of stance in the negotiations. We also think we stand with teachers because their working conditions are the students' learning conditions. And generally speaking, as parents, we find that the teachers are our allies for educating our children.
Well, in Washington State, there's been a big issue over standardized testing. Has that been an issue here in Oregon?
Well, it has been an issue, and it's been an issue in some ways more at the state level, but it does connect to questions like last year, not so much directly in these negotiations, but the administration put forward some school closing plans, which came on top of some closures the year before that had already affected primarily schools in North and Northeast Portland that tend to serve lower income and people of color. And, you know, effective teaching can make a difference, but it's also not really fair to teachers to evaluate the effectiveness of their teaching when the students that they may be dealing with vary so tremendously in the resources that they bring into the classroom. So there's, you know, something that needs to be worked out there in terms of wanting to promote effective teaching and at the same time being fair in evaluating, you know, there are teachers who make it their point to go and teach in the hardest classrooms with the kids who have the most challenges, and some of them are very good at that and really help those kids, but, you know, they could try and go to a different school and teach kids with a lot of advantages, and it's not really fair to evaluate teachers who make those choices, and, you know, just solely on the sort of outcomes. They're probably driven by the inequalities in our society more than anything else.
If people are interested in getting involved or coming to tomorrow's rally, can you give people some more information about that?
Sure. The rally is going to happen at the school department, the school system's headquarters, which is called the BESC building, and the address is 501 North Dixon, which is in the Rose Quarter. It's a pretty hard little area to get to. People would probably want to check it out on a map program or something. But we're going to start at 9 and finish up by 10. We have a Facebook presence. The Parents Stand with Portland Teachers, and so if people wanted to make contact there for if they wanted to get involved beyond the rally, that would be probably the simplest way to do that now.
Well, thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
I've been speaking with Chris Lowe of Parents Stand with Portland Teachers. Their Facebook group is Parents Stand with Portland Teachers. The rally is tomorrow, Wednesday, December 18th at 9 a.m. at the Portland Public School Administration Building, 501 North Dixon Avenue. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
Late last night, a group of activists were able to temporarily block a 900,000-pound megaload near John Day, Oregon. Protesters locked themselves to disabled vehicles to try to delay the shipment from crossing through Oregon and Idaho to get to the Alberta tar sands in Canada. Members of Rising Tide helped to organize last night's protest. It followed a protest at the megaload's launch in Umatilla 2 weeks ago. After that, protesters in Washington occupied an office of the shipping company Omega Morgan. The company's based in Hillsboro, but no protests have been organized yet at the company's main office. Organizers of last night's protest said that police used aggressive force to remove the people who were nonviolently blocking the megaload truck. For more, we go to KBOO's Sequoia Wright.
I'm speaking with Yoko Silk with Rising Tide. Yoko, what happened at the tar sands megaload protest today?
Okay, so in John Day, this was the continuation of this megaload's route through a very circuitous route through eastern Oregon, starting in the port of Umatilla, and it had reached John Day. And so last night, activists decided to construct a couple of blockades on Highway 26 on the megaload's route and continued east. And they constructed two different blockades, one being a car with two people locked to the car in the path of the megaload. And the second blockade was a trailer with two people locked onto various parts of the trailer. One individual was locked to a barrel on top of the trailer, an arm in a lockbox encased in cement in a barrel, and then the other individual was locked to the axle of the trailer in that second blockade. And so the activists were out there their hope was to stop the megaload again. We were able to stop it on December 1st. For the first time, activists were able to stop it using nonviolent direct action, and we're hoping to have similar success. Police were kind of out of the line aggressive towards both the people that were locked onto the car and the trailer, but also towards the other individuals that were there as support and not planning on getting arrested. So the police aggressively arrested individuals that were watching and supporting the first blockade, and I've heard from arrestees that the police were using pain compliance to remove the individuals from the car, and multiple arrestees are experiencing minor injuries such as bruised wrists. The second blockade, I hear that the police, when they wanted to move the trailer out of the road, they gathered enough people together to pull the trailer and drag it while the person was still locked to the axle, and they were being dragged on the ground while the trailer was being moved.
Okay, and 16 people were arrested, correct?
So my newest numbers, what I just got updated about an hour ago, is that actually 18 people were arrested, and one of them was a minor, and so they were released pretty much immediately. And these 17 people that are still in custody are being told that they are staying in the Clark County Jail again tonight, or sorry, the Grant County Jail, and they're staying in jail tonight, and we will know more details about their arraignment tomorrow morning, hopefully. The other issue with this particular load is that they're being transported through Umatilla ceded territory in eastern Oregon. And the Umatilla tribe has recently sent a letter expressing opposition to the megaloads. They sent a letter to Governor Kitzhaber due to the lack of consultation with the tribes and the roles of tar sands in extracting and harming indigenous people and fueling global climate change. And this is in conjunction with this summer, the Nez Perce tribe filed an injunction against Omega Morgan as well, because one of their routes through Idaho was blocked by this injunction.
Okay, I've been speaking with Yoko Silk of Portland Rising Tide, reporting about 16 arrested as climate justice groups halt controversial tar sands megaload. Is there any other place that folks can go to help, and how can they support Portland Rising Tide?
Thank you for asking that. Yeah, since we have 16 arrests this time, and we had two arrests the last time we had one of these actions happen, we have numerous people that have a lot of legal fees coming up, and so it would be really great. We're really asking people to support these people that are putting their life on the lines, to help stop these projects. And so you can go to portlandrisingtide.org and find out how to support financially or support in other ways. There's email links and who to contact if you are interested in getting involved. I encourage you to do that. www.portlandrisingtide.org.
That was Sequoyna Wright speaking to Yoko Silk of Rising Tide.
Last night, KBOO reporter Kristen Yount attended a meeting of the St. John's Neighborhood Association. The meeting was called by the Portland Harbor Citizen Action Group concerning the latest study released regarding the Superfund site on the Willamette River. The EPA could consider a confined disposal facility, or CDF, along the Willamette to help clean up the Superfund. Representatives from the Environmental Protection Agency and other groups gave presentations before a quorum of Neighborhood Association members who, in the end, voted to support the removal of sediments and not the storage of those materials so close to an already toxic neighborhood and critical habitat for local fish. The 11-mile stretch of the Willamette River designated a Superfund cleanup site 13 years ago stretches from the confluence of the Columbia and Willamette in North Portland to near the Broadway Bridge. Two potential disposal sites are being researched by the EPA, one at Mile 4 near Pier Park in St. John's, and one near Swan Island. Barbara Quinn from the Portland Harbor Community Action Group, or CAG, spoke about potential dangers not yet fully addressed.
Assessment is not complete if it does not deal with mixtures of chemical pollutants, has no evaluation of increased sensitivity of groups such as children, and has no estimate of risks for people with elevated background risks, that would be all of us that live here, and has no attempt to assess the cumulative risks for the community. As far as I know, our human health risk assessment does not take into consideration accumulation. The USA Today did a study in 2008 that pinpointed that actually using EPA's own data, and it became clear that we have a number of schools here in North Portland that are very affected by toxic air. Next. In fact, Sitton School is already in the in the top 3% nationwide of schools exposed to toxic air pollution, and James John and Holy Cross are also in the top 3%. Next. Roosevelt, George, and Clarendon are in the 1 percentile. So of 180,000 high schools in this country, Roosevelt High School is in the top 300 for exposure to toxic air. Human health risk assessment is not complete if it does not deal with mixtures of chemical pollutants, has no evaluation of increased sensitivity of groups such as children, and has no estimate of risks for people with elevated background risks, that would be all of us that live here, and has no attempt to assess the cumulative risks for the community. As far as I know, our human health risk assessment does not take into consideration accumulation.
Also in attendance was Barbara Smith of the Lower Willamette Group, or LWG. She described the LWG's role in the Superfund project.
The Lower Willamette Group, as has been described, is a group of public and private entities that came together under an order from EPA and DEQ. It's a court-entered order. We exist to do basically one thing, which is to provide the technical and scientific studies and analysis for EPA to make a decision about the cleanup of the river. Now, there are a lot of members of the LWG, and you saw the list there, the city and the port and Gunderson and Northwest Natural and others. As I think EPA and Barbara Quinn described, there are hundreds of other what's known as potentially responsible parties who have not so far contributed to the studies or the technology analysis or the sampling. Anyway, I want to just describe what our mission is. Our mission is to complete these studies and give them to EPA so they can make a decision. Our job is not to advocate for one remedy over the other. The other thing that I want to acknowledge is that over the course of the last 12 years, we have produced millions and millions of data points and thousands of pages of analysis. We've also worked, I think, closely with the community, and in many areas, our work has been changed by community input. So what you're hearing tonight about the proposed plan and the community's involvement in making decisions about your river really are true. And the one that I can give the example of is a few years ago, we were not giving enough attention to the idea of innovative technologies, and we heard pretty loud and clear from the community advisory group that we needed to do more work on that. So that's an example of something where the community's input really does make a difference. So as we go forward, we are working at the direction of EPA. They are the ones who will make the decision based on your...
Representatives from the EPA reviewed different ways to proceed with cleanup and emphasized the importance of community involvement. After they spoke, Travis Williams, president of the Willamette River Keepers, endorsed the idea of a contained disposal facility because the cost associated with trucking waste off-site could hamper efforts to fully restore the river.
Look at the tremendous amount of work the DEQ is doing all along the riverside area on both sides of the river to control those sources. And then, after we do that, we get to figuring out what to do with the silty river sediments. In my view, I think we ought to remove as much sediment as possible from the Willamette River. That gives you the best long-term certainty that this cleanup will be done and be done right. The difficult question becomes, when we look at how these decisions are made, if we have to take sediment a long way from the river, and we want to remove a lot of sediment, but we have to dispose of it potentially 100 miles away, 50 miles away, it factors into the cost of this cleanup. I believe that under the right circumstances, that it can be a viable option that is completely protective. You can look at, or at least has a very low risk. Right now, all that stuff's in the Willamette River. We're talking about if a CDF was to be built, You would concentrate that material in one area, you'd be able to monitor it in one spot, you'd be able to deal with any issues that might arise over time. Some people have mentioned earthquakes. If we had a 9.5 earthquake in Portland, that berm might slough off a little bit and burp a little bit of sediment into the river. Well, I tell you, and I'm not trying to be smart here, but you know, you would look down to the skyline of the city of Portland and it would look different. I think a CDF that would potentially fail under an extreme earthquake would be pretty far down the list, actually, in terms of our priorities after such an event. Now, that's not dismissing it out of hand. We have to think about these things if such a structure was to be built. So again, our position is, let's remove sediment, let's dispose of it in a way that's protective.
At the end of the presentation, a motion was made on the floor of the meeting for the St. John's Neighborhood Association to support the removal of sediment without storing the sediment on the shores of the river and to protect the fish habitat. The motion passed almost unanimously. To hear a complete transcript of the meeting and for more information, please visit our website, kboo.fm.
The National Marine Fisheries Service recently approved the U.S. Navy's 5-year plan to do testing and training activities off Hawaii and Southern California. In Hawaii, a lawsuit has been filed to challenge the approval because of the harmful effects of the testing and training on marine mammals. For more on the story, KBOO reporter Genevieve McDaniel spoke with David Henkin from Earth Justice in Hawaii.
What is your organization?
I work with Earth Justice, which is a nonprofit environmental law firm.
The U.S. Navy just received approval by the National Marine Fisheries Service for a 5-year plan to do testing and training activities off of Hawaii and Southern California. Can you speak to how that will affect the marine wildlife?
The Navy did an estimate of what the effects on marine mammals would be of its training and testing in Hawaii and Southern California, and it came up with the following. Over the next 5 years, it expects to kill up to 155 marine mammals, including potentially endangered whale species like the blue whale and the fin whale. It expects to injure permanently over 2,000 more marine mammals, and that could be hearing loss or damage to their internal organs from the blast from Navy sonar or explosives. And on top of all of that, there's going to be about 9.6 million individual instances in which other marine mammals will be harmed or harassed, prevented from feeding and breeding and resting. So really an incredible devastation all across the Pacific.
Is there any idea of how many endangered species are in the areas that have been approved?
Yes. The area is home to about 43 different species of marine mammals. Not all of them are on the federal endangered species list, but there are 5 species of endangered whale that are on the list, as well as the endangered insular Hawaii false killer whale and the critically endangered Hawaiian monk seal, which is down to only about 1,100 individuals in the world. There's also the threatened Guadalupe fur seal, and then in the non-marine mammal context, there are also endangered and threatened sea turtles that will be harmed by the training.
Can you discuss the lawsuit that is challenging the approval?
Yeah, in a nutshell, what the lawsuit is seeking is for the Fisheries Service and the Navy to fulfill their legal obligation to look at alternate courses of action, other things that the Navy can do to achieve its mission, but do it at much less environmental cost. Specifically, we believe that the Fisheries Service and the Navy should be looking at alternatives for training that would place off limits very small areas in the ocean. While small in size, they're critically important for the marine mammals. And so these are areas of high concentration of various marine mammals that would be harmed by Navy training and testing. You have to keep in mind that the Navy is planning on conducting these activities in an area of the ocean about as large as all 50 United States combined. So it's a huge, huge area. And we contend that there's a lot of room in the ocean and that they can set aside a few limited areas where marine mammals can go about their business in peace and survive. And that would substantially reduce the number of animals injured and killed.
Can you speak to why this is so important?
Well, you know, we believe that we have an obligation morally, but also these agencies have an obligation legally to try and reduce the impacts of their activities on these critically endangered marine mammals. They're highly intelligent creatures, and we shouldn't be injuring and killing them needlessly. As mentioned, we believe that the Navy can fulfill its mission, can conduct training and testing without causing this level of catastrophic damage, and it can do that by simply placing off limits some very limited areas of highest concentration for some of these very sensitive and vulnerable marine mammals.
I have been speaking with David Henkin from Earth Justice. This is Genevieve McDaniel with KBOO News.
The United for Marriage campaign is continuing to collect signatures even though they have enough. Oregon United for Marriage is a campaign to legalize same-sex marriage in Oregon. Once they have gone through the rest of the qualification process, they will be able to have their initiative put on next year's ballot. Until then, they're collecting extra signatures to be certain they have enough for the Secretary of State to certify. In 2004, Oregon voters passed a ban on same-sex marriage. If the Oregon United for Marriage campaign is passed and same-sex marriages are legalized, Oregon could make history by being the first state to repeal a ban on gay marriage that voters had previously passed. Oregon United for Marriage collected 4,000 signatures in 1 week and has a total of more than 120,000 signatures.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with a supporter of the Postal Service who was one of the six protesters arrested in Springfield, Oregon last night. At 6, Out Loud. Tonight's Out Loud welcomes the crew of the Sexual and Gender Minority Youth Resource Center as they celebrate their 15th birthday. Out Loud will also check in with former Out Loud Collective member Sasha Bookert by phone to hear about her work on transgender laws in California. At 7, Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip-hop. Tomorrow's weather, a high of 44 degrees with a chance of rain and snow, and a low of 30 degrees. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are counts permitted in North Portland, 32, with a high of 57. Powell Butte measures 28 CPM, and Sitka, Alaska has a radiation count of 34 counts per minute with spikes up to 56. EPA alert levels start at 100 CPM. More information can be found at radcast.org.
It's 5:29. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
We've learned from hard experience that the moral values of corporate chieftains rarely penetrate deeper than the value of their multimillion-dollar pay packages. But shouldn't we expect more from the chieftains of colleges and universities? After all, campuses are places of erudition and enlightenment, where we hope students will absorb a bit of our society's deeper ethical principles, including our historic commitment to fairness and egalitarian justice. Yet, community college officials in my town of Austin, Texas, recently issued an edict that could have come straight out of Walmart. The headline on a newspaper story about the college's edict reads, "Adjuncts at ACC face cut in hours. School seeks to avoid paying for health care." Of nearly 2,000 faculty members at the sprawling Austin Community College, three-fourths are, quote, adjunct professors who get low pay and no health care benefits. But the new Obamacare law would have finally given them a break by requiring colleges to provide health coverage to employees who work 30 hours or more a week. But the honchos of ACC, a school with the word community in its name, have snatched this basic element of human decency out of the adjunct faculty's hands by arbitrarily decreeing that none can work more than 28 hours a week. That's a double whammy. Not only are the college chiefs denying needed health care for the people who carry ACC's teaching load, But the sneaky cut in hours means that these poorly paid professors will also suffer a pay cut. It's the Walmartization of higher education, and it's happening at all levels all across the country. This is Jim Hightower saying, did I mention that ACC provides full health coverage for the college's president and other well-paid administrators who are nixing coverage for the adjuncts? Now, isn't that a fine ethical lesson for the students to absorb?
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
A newly published list of donors to the Center for American Progress includes the likes of Big Pharma's Eli Lilly and too-big-to-fail banks like Wells Fargo. KBOO's Robin Ryan spoke with Mary Boyle, Director of Communications at Common Cause, about the implications of money on policy development and democratic processes.
I'm talking with Mary Boyle. She is the Communications Director at Common Cause. Thanks for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
The Center for American Progress, their list of funders over the weekend got published. Is it safe to characterize the names on that list? I don't know if you've gotten a chance to look at it as surprising.
I would say not. The fact is that corporations try to spread their influence all around, from the right, left, and center. And I think what you're seeing at CAP is not that unusual.
What do you think are the implications of groups that are known historically for funding conservative, corporate-friendly causes, also providing financial support to what we view as the other side of the political fence?
And the fact is that corporations spend on the left, too, and they spend in the middle, and they spend on the right, and it's part of their strategy to get their influence all over. Yes, they may be a little more aligned with the right. But, for example, we've seen stories recently that Google, for example, gives money to the Heritage Foundation as well as to PFAW, People for the American Way. So it is not that shocking. From a Common Cause perspective, there will always be a concern when there is big corporate money influencing public policy.
Do you see this dynamic as part and parcel to the problematic nature of money in politics? And if so, what form do you see remedy taken?
Certainly. It is just yet another example of the growing influence of corporate money on our democracy. And Citizens United kind of opened the floodgates by saying corporations can spend unlimited amounts on political campaigns. This is another more subtle way to spread that influence, but certainly another way. And we see the solutions as in a short, medium, and long term. There's no magic bullet to this situation. We need strengthened disclosure laws. We need to change the way we pay for politics so small donors have a bigger voice in our politics and it's not dominated by whoever can write the biggest checks. And lastly, we need a constitutional amendment to recognize that corporations are not people, to recognize that reasonable contribution limits are a good thing, and we need to get that through the states and through Congress and amend the Constitution. So it's a big lift, but there's a lot of work already underway.
And what message would you have for folks who are disappointed by this disclosure?
In this day and age, there is corporate influence that is everywhere, and this is another example of it. Common Cause is working to fight back on Citizens United and get big money out of politics. Our website is www.commoncause.org.
For KBOO News, this is Robin Ryan.
Oregon's own Bernie Madoff is on his way to prison for a scheme that cost investors over $13 million. Craig Berkman was once the manager of some of Portland's largest investment firms and is a former head of the Oregon Republican Party. In 2008, he was found guilty of defrauding Oregon investors who had hoped to purchase shares in Facebook, Groupon, LinkedIn, and other major companies. Berkman initially faced a maximum of 40 years in prison for security and wire fraud. After pleading guilty to both charges in June, He was found guilty and sentenced to 6 years in federal prison. His arrest shocked business leaders in Oregon, many of whom had a close working relationship with Berkman for years. His friends and investors included Jordan Schnitzer of Harsh Investment Properties, Bill Furman, the CEO of Greenbrier, and timber executive Harry Demarest. Craig Berkman will begin serving his sentence immediately in a federal prison in Oregon.
And now the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. UAW Region 1C Director Norwood Jewell says the United Auto Workers Union wants to end the two-tier wage system at the Detroit 3. That system pays some new hires much less than veteran UAW members at Chrysler, Ford, and General Motors. Jewell told reporters in Flint, Michigan that the UAW hates the two-tier system and will work to get rid of it. New hires under the two-tier system now hire in at just under $16 an hour. That wage can rise to $19 over time, while veteran UAW members make about $28 an hour. Roughly 16% of GM's 51,000 UAW members make that lower wage. At Ford, it's about 19%, and at Chrysler, it's close to 25%. The UAW will be in contract talks with the Detroit 3 in 2015. Nancy Becker is an American working for Amazon in Germany. She traveled to Seattle recently to dare Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos to try working as a picker in an Amazon warehouse for just a single week. She doesn't think he could survive it because the work is physically demanding and wages are low. These workers, known as pickers, pick out the merchandise ordered by Amazon customers for shipment. Amazon workers in Germany have been striking over the low pay and working conditions. Nancy Becker came to Seattle, Amazon's world headquarters, to participate in rallies, driving home the point that while Bezos, other executives, and Amazon shareholders are getting rich, Amazon workers are suffering. Becker says the Amazon system is characterized by low wages and permanent performance pressures. The National Institute on Retirement Security says blacks and Latinos in the United States own shockingly little assets for their retirement. In a recent report, the Institute says 62% of black American workers and 69% of Latino workers own no assets in retirement accounts. The report also notes that 3 out of 4 black households and 4 out of 5 Latino households, ages 25 to 64, have less than $10,000 in retirement savings. 1 out of 2 white households have less than $10,000 in retirement savings. In a different study, the Economic Policy Institute found that the American retirement system simply doesn't work for most workers and underscores the importance of preserving and strengthening Social Security and also defending the remaining defined benefit private pensions.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. Bank of Labor offers a business Visa card with no annual fee and points earned with every purchase, as well as rental vehicle and travel accident insurance. More info online at bankoflabor.com.
Don't be afraid. Fight for what you believe to be right. We deserve more. We're worth more.
McDonald's is making $5.5 billion off of profits last year. Arby's made $1.5 billion off of profits last year. So why is we getting all these low minimum wage jobs? We sit up in a poor neighborhood trying to survive. Enough is enough. We're tired. It's time to rise up.
Keep the voices of workers and their unions on the National Radio News airwaves every day. Support Workers Independent News right now by donating at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Monday, December 16, 2013. Israeli soldiers have invaded various Palestinian communities in different parts of the occupied West Bank and kidnapped 5 Palestinians. These stories and more are coming up. Stay tuned. Palestinian media sources reported that Israeli troops kidnapped 3 Palestinians from Hijja and Jayus villages near Qalqilia in the northwest of the West Bank. The Israeli military claimed that the 3 were wanted for what they called security violations. Furthermore, dozens of Israeli soldiers invaded Jabaa village near the northern West Bank city of Jenin. Eyewitnesses in the village said that troops kidnapped Ibrahim Baddad, 38 years old, and Murad Malaysia, 23. The eyewitnesses said that the army forced the families out into the cold amidst the snowstorm and searched their homes. On Sunday evening, Israeli military sources reported that an Israeli soldier was shot and killed by rounds fired allegedly coming from the Lebanese side of the border by a Lebanese soldier. Israeli Daily Haaretz reported that Tel Aviv has filed an official complaint against Lebanon with the United Nations, adding that the incident will not likely lead to confrontation between Lebanon and Israel. According to Haaretz, around 8:30 p.m., while an Israeli military vehicle was patrolling a border area, around 6 to 7 rounds of live ammunition were fired, likely from a light firearm and from a relatively close range. Furthermore, the Lebanese army has reported that one of its soldiers is missing and that Israeli soldiers likely abducted him. Similar to the Israeli army, the Lebanese armed forces declared a state of emergency in the area. Also on Sunday, Israeli soldiers have violently attacked a young Palestinian man from Hebron, causing moderate injuries that required hospitalization. Another man was injured after being rammed by a military vehicle. Medical sources said that a number of Israeli soldiers violently assaulted resident Iyad Hosniya from the Al-Arub refugee camp in Hebron as he was returning home. He was moved to Beit Jala Governmental Hospital in Bethlehem, suffering moderate injuries. That's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, December 16th News Roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please keep visiting our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hassan Banoura and me, George Rishnow.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, a statement today from the NATO International Military Coalition reported that one person survived the crash of an aircraft that killed the other 6 crew members. The crash took place in southern Afghanistan. It's not yet reported if it was the result of an attack by the Taliban. In other news from Afghanistan, the U.S. government is pushing Afghan President Hamid Karzai to sign a security agreement by December 31st. It would have U.S. troops out by the end of 2014. Karzai refuses to sign until the U.S. ends airstrikes in the region.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Robin Ryan, Genevieve McDaniel, Kristen Yount, Jimmy Tardy, and Kelly Connor Sunrose. The producer and engineer is Sequoina Wright. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue, you're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Rosalind Scott.
And I'm Liam Delta. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, Democracy Now! With award-winning journalists Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Wednesday Talk Radio, Lisa Loving speaks with writer and activist Ronald Catalani, or Polo, about his recent article, What's Missing from Smart People's Problem-Solving Methodology? At 9 on Political Perspectives, Bruce Silverman interviews 2 Portland natives, Liza Gadsby and Peter Jenkins. They're the first people to do research on the drill, a very rare primate found in Africa. They'll discuss their program for the breeding and conservation of drills. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Flashpoints, in investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, Chris Siegel and Peter Schoaf host the KBOO Food Show. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support of community radio. If you're not a KBOO member yet, you can become one now by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Now stay tuned for an interview conducted by KBOO reporter Jimmy Tardy about last night's action to try to save the Postal Processing Center in Springfield, Oregon. And that will be followed by Out Loud. Tonight, they welcome the crew of the Sexual and Gender Minority Youth Resource Center as they celebrate their 15th birthday. And they will also check in with former collective member Sasha Bookert by phone to hear about her work on transgender laws in California. Have a good night. Good night, Rosalind.
Good night, Liam.
I'm speaking with Reverend John Schweibert, who was arrested yesterday at the Springfield mail facility. It's a mail sorting facility, the Springfield Gateway, along with six others who occupied the loading dock at the facility, demanding that the plant manager, Robert Vohr, suspend the scheduled closure of the mail sorting facility in Springfield, and demanded also to speak with Mr. Vohr. Mr. Vohr apparently observed the protest through glass doors, refused to meet with the, quote, postal protectors, and when they refused to leave, had the seven of them arrested. As they were arrested, the crowd outside cheered as they were led away in handcuffs. Thanks for being with me, John. And why did you get arrested yesterday in Springfield?
Well, I think I'd have to say that we're trying to do everything we can to get attention, to call the public's attention to this travesty that's going on with the degradation of postal service. We're trying to save the post office and get them to stop the cuts and closures. And sometimes being willing to take a protest and occupation to the point of arrest seems like a valid way of getting the job done.
The Springfield mail sorting facility is scheduled to be closed in, I believe, February of next year.
That's right, yeah.
And this facility is not unique.
No, there have been facilities in other cities around the country that have been closed. In Oregon, the Salem facility was closed last year in spite of our protest, in spite of the fact that we got arrested occupying the loading dock in Salem. Of course, what that means, practically speaking, is the mail isn't being sorted in Salem, and now it won't be sorted in Eugene if this goes through, which means that the Portland facility is going to be sorting all the mail that was sorted by the three facilities. And, of course, that's going to mean delay of the mail for everybody.
And it also is going to eliminate, according to the press release that was issued by Communities and Postal Workers United, their spokesperson, Jamie Partridge, was quoted as saying that this represents almost 200 good-paying, family-supporting jobs will be lost.
Yes, right. I mean, some of those people will come to Portland if they can, but that's asking an awful lot of a family, too, to pull up their roots and come to Portland.
Right. It's quite a commute, quite a move for families if they decide to make a permanent change in residence, and it is an extra haul and a delay in mail processing.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the way that the Postal Service changes are playing out locally, with facilities being closed, properties being sold. Let's talk a little bit about what's going on nationwide.
Well, smaller post offices are being closed. Rural post offices are deemed less important because they're basing the value of a post office on the volume, which is totally contrary to the principle by which the post office was originally created.
Share a little bit about that principle.
Well, the intention of Benjamin Franklin, when he put forth the idea of a postal service, that was even before we became a country, and he said that it's necessary, it's vital to a democracy that everybody be connected and have a way of getting information, no matter where they live, no matter how remote their dwelling was. They should all have, and for the same cost, the same price, the opportunity to communicate with other people throughout this land.
Those are especially telling remarks in light of the revelations regarding the NSA and its spying and the potential for abuse that lies in that communication medium.
Mm-hmm.
It's one thing for authorities to open and read one person's mail. That's enough effort on their part. It's a completely different picture when you're talking about electronic communication and how easy it is to sweep up all of a person's communications.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, they're sweeping up everyone's communications that are happening electronically.
Certainly, yes.
So that's one aspect of what's going on here. This is a privacy issue, but it also gets a little deeper into some of the things that Congress has mandated within the past decade regarding Postal Service management and its finances.
Yeah, there's been a representation that the post office is losing money, which we're finding out is not true. There's actually some miscommunication going on, deliberate lying, I would say, to the American people about the condition of the Postal Service financially. It's actually made a profit this last year. They have presented it as a loss because of the requirement made by Congress that the Postal Service prefund its pension program for all of its employees for 75 years in advance. And so it hasn't even been able to do that, but it shows as a loss on the books. And so they're saying, oh, whoa, we're losing money. We've got to do something different, close facilities and cut services.
Right, you're referring to the 2006 congressional mandate, which apparently does a couple of different things. It requires the U.S. Postal Service to pre-fund retiree health benefits 75 years in advance.
That's right, yeah.
And apparently the United States Postal Service has also been overpaying to the tune of tens of billions of dollars into pension funds.
Yes.
So when you hear something like a requirement to prepay health benefits 75 years in advance, is there any rational argument that could be made that that's a reasonable thing to do, especially in light of the fact that there is no other institution that is under those requirements?
No, there's no reasonable reason to expect that. And I have to say it's a conspiracy. It's being promoted by the private sector so that they can weaken the post office so that when they take it over, then the service, which is actually profitable, that's why they want it, those profits can go into private pockets instead of having it be a part of the public resource. It is supposed to be a postal service. It's supposed to serve the people. It should be a service of the people, by the people, and for the people. But attempts are being made to privatize it and corporatize it for the benefit of the few. Just one of many things that's happening leading toward privatization of things that were public or should be public.
So I understand that the National Association of Letter Carriers is supporting passage of Representative Stephen Lynch's bill, H.R. 5746.
I'm not fully acquainted with all the legislation that is before Congress. But yes, there are efforts being made to try to get the whole thing moving in the opposite direction.
And that is Representative Stephen Lynch. He's a Democrat from Massachusetts. He's also pushing for no cuts in pay and benefits. He's mandating that there's no elimination of collective bargaining rights and that service isn't being slashed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting when you rehash the numbers in light of the 75-year prepaying into the retiree health benefit fund and the overpayments that are going into the pension funds, that the United States Postal Service actually appears to be showing a profit, a significant profit.
Yes.
According to factcheck.org, they say that if you take out that 75-year pre-funding mandate, the Postal Service actually shows a $700 million profit over the last 4 years.
Yes. And, of course, that pretty much proves that there's not a need to slash services anywhere. The money is coming in, no money from taxation, but money coming in from services are able to fund it and keep it going. It's a wonderful invention, and it's been working well. And it's the fault of Congress not giving it a chance to do what it's meant to do. All along the way, Congress has meddled. It, you know, when they created the United States Postal Service back in the 70s, they said run it like a business. And they've been running it like a business, and it's been working. But then along the way, Congress has required certain things that it must do, which in effect interferes with the operation of the service.
It is worth noting that on the individual level, first-class stamp is, I think, about 43 cents nowadays.
Yes.
That's actually a pretty small price to pay for keeping alive such a large public service.
Yes. And it's significantly less than Canada, for instance, and other countries in Europe. One country, I forget which one it is, actually has it's over a dollar for a first-class postage stamp. We've got one of the best postal services in the world. Now, you wouldn't know that if you walked into the post office and wonder why there aren't more people at those windows, but that's part of the systematic degrading of the process, too. So we're really in a big mess, and the more we can do to call the public's attention to that and realize that that the idea that the postal service is in trouble because of not enough use is just not true. It's in trouble because Congress is not giving it a chance to do what it's mandated to do by the Constitution and by its own regulations.
Anything else you want to say about your efforts locally here, John, and the situation as far as postal workers here?
Well, I just want to say in general that part of the purpose of privatization is to be able to secure labor at lower cost. And that's one of the things that we've been concerned about locally, that there, even though there's denials of it by postal management, we have evidence coming from inside some of the processing facilities here that some of it is already, some of the postal transport and sorting is already being privatized. And what that means is that union postal employees are being laid off. And the private contractors, mostly just small contractors, are going out and recruiting people for minimum wage to do the same work that was being done by people that were receiving an affordable wage because they're operating under union contracts. So that's a very deep concern that we have. The post office department is the second largest employer, I believe, in the United States, and a significant number of the employees, higher than in any other industry or business, are minorities. So here is a public institution that has done a great deal to bring minority people into the middle class, and now an attempt is being made to push back all those gains by privatizing services and having them done by cheaper labor.
What's the union that represents postal workers locally?
Well, there are four different unions, and I'm not a union person myself. Otherwise, I'd be able to just say the names right off. But it would include letter carriers and unions of people that are doing the processing, and the people who work in the post offices, retail people, and so on. But I believe there's four different unions. They're all beginning to realize that they've got to work now together in order to help push back on what's happening to the Postal Service. Their jobs are at stake.
Is there anything that you suggest people to get involved with, or a way for people to connect with this issue and become active in it themselves?
Well, certainly talk about it. And when people say things, I have this up all the time to me, people say, well, it's terrible what's happening to the Postal Service, but I guess that's what happens in the age of computers and email. We just can't afford it anymore. And it's time we've got to say, well, wait a minute, that's not true. You're getting bad information. The Postal Service is adapting to changes in consumer usage, and they can do it. Every industry has to adapt, and the Postal Service can do it too, and it is doing it. but it's doing it without any help from Congress, for one thing.
And not only no help, but an actual significant hindrance.
That's right.
So to get more information on this issue, the Communities and Postal Workers United. There's also a National Community and Postal Workers United.
Yeah, and there's a website, and there's a lot of information about that, and a lot of information about the kind of things that we've been talking about here. People want to study it more. And if you call one of us, we'd be glad to have you join us at the next action. We're not sure where and when. We're looking at a lot of different possibilities, but we're in this struggle for the long haul.
Would you like to put out a contact number?
I'd be happy to have people contact me, John Schweibert. My number at the 18th Avenue Peace House is, 503-281-3697.
Thank you for your time, John. And
you're so welcome. Yeah. Okay. Goodbye.
Goodbye. For KBO News, I'm Jimmy Tardy. I've been speaking with John Schweibert of Communities and Postal Workers United.
Hey, KBU supporters, we just sent you a card, so watch your mailbox. It's an opportunity to give a little more assistance at this time of year to your listener-sponsored, volunteer-powered community radio station. Yep, tax time. That means that your donation makes a difference. And it'll really make a difference for KBU because you can help us qualify for Oregon Cultural Trust matching funds. You can get more information about this on our website at kboo.fm/year-end-gift-2013.
This KBU program is made possible in part by KBU Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.